J'ai plumé la tête de mon alouette.
J'ai plumé la tête de mon alouette.
J'ai plumé la tête de la queue, pète, pète, elle de zèle, vente la dôme.
Hello and welcome. This is a series that we like to call as Nerd Kitchen. And we'll talk a lot about food, things that inspire us. Also bring in a bit of trivia and some food science while we're at it, trying to keep it as simple as possible. You have myself, Max, and I'm joined by Macro Ajit. If you are on Instagram, you probably already know of him. So that's pretty much what you can expect from this series. And before I talk too much, I'll just have Ajit talk about himself and what the series.
Okay. Thanks, Max. I think it's a great idea on your part. So hi, everyone. My name is Ajit Bhaskar. I am at Macro Ajit on Instagram. I am a scientist by profession. So as a kid, we used to have those long summer vacations for like 2 months or so. My maternal grandparents, they owned us. I mean, they still do own a sweet shop. And as a kid, I used to raid that shop very regularly. So my interest in like food started when I was a child. I used to go to the shop with my mama, say hi to Tata. And I used to be a terror at the shop because I used to literally just go there and eat anything. And the employees couldn't say a damn thing because I was literally like the grandson of the owners. And as such, massive pampering happened. So whatever, chips, badusha, but not just that. I also saw how things were made, right? So those days, a lot of the peanut shells and the wood chips were used as fuels, which not only, added to the fuel bit of it, but it also, you know, imparted a certain taste in certain food items. And all the huge pots and pans where they used to fry, you know, wearing a towel, all that sort of stuff. So just in addition to eating, I've also witnessed how food was made at that scale at a very young age. So my interest in food has been there for quite some time. So when I went to the US, I found out that I was putting on a lot of weight. I used to be about 20, 21 kgs heavier than what I am today. So I realized that I need to do something about it. So thankfully, in the US, things are available fairly easily. If you hunt for stuff in a supermarket, you get a lot of good stuff. So that's when this whole interest in cooking as such started. And since by nature I'm experimental, I love to think of the kitchen as a space for channeling creativity. So one thing led to another. It started with cooking, then it started with baking. And now I just like to sort of experiment with different types of flavors, different cuisines. And now with a recent change in life, we have a kid at our place, so how to, you know, feed the kid different stuff, keep it interesting. So I guess it's been like a long fun ride, but yeah, I to me, like, cooking and baking is like massive passion, so I really really enjoy that stuff.
I don't have half a exciting story as you, but because mine's very simple. I started cooking because of your wife. Now, that doesn't sound very nice, but it is the fact.
Okay.
Our mutual love for Padmalakshmi and Top Chef is what got me.
Yes. Yeah.
She was watching it for the food. I was watching it for the,
Yep. I mean, it's also food, but for the eyes, I guess.
Well, it was true. I started watching because of the view and not the viewpoint. And yeah. That's what got me interested. And then I started experimenting a bit myself because for me, I mean, people who know me will know this. For me, there are three C's for me in life. There is code, cooking, and cricket.
Appa, okay.
Those are my three C's. And so my approach to cooking, therefore, is very much like a hacker, you know, food hacking. That's kind of been my approach towards cooking. And I always think like that, okay, what can be done? If you think about it, cooking has the very same constraints like code, almost most science disciplines also have the same thing. There is a process, there are reactions, there are allocation of resources and timing, right? All those, all those factors come together and that's what comes out as a dish. So my approach has been very, at that level towards food, when I start looking at a recipe online, I'm like, okay, I like this recipe. I see what you've done, but I don't have those exact very ingredients and, you know, maybe you want to do something different.
Yeah.
Yeah. That brings me to what as I talk to people, I've noticed that you could put people in four or five types. The first type is the very, you know, well-loved, enthusiastic, giving cooks, you know, that who love to cook for gatherings and friends, and they make all these family favorites, and which sometimes, you know, are not very healthy and all that, but it's soul food and that kind of stuff. Then there are the people who are like overtly healthy, you know, they will, you know, sacrifice taste or anything because it is healthy, like eating boiled stuff or things like that. And then there are these methodical cooks. I know a lot of people who fall. In fact, my wife falls into one in that bracket.
Okay.
Like heavily on recipes, and you know, their creation has to look exactly like what the picture what they saw on Instagram or on Pinterest or something. Otherwise, like, oh, this didn't come out well. And I always say, what do you mean this didn't come out well? It tastes good. Like, no. Like, I didn't have that which this recipe wanted, and you know, things like that. And then come the these competitive chefs who like to show off, and they want to say, look, I know how to do molecular gastronomy and that kind of stuff.
Sadly, it's a very abused word, and I won't blame people for that, but it's a kind of a very interesting way of looking at food.
It is, and I hope we talk about it in one of the episodes.
Yeah.
The way I'm talking is like, when you don't need to, like, you know, just doing
the sake
of doing, like, oh, I want to post on my profile that, you know, this is what I did, things like that. And the last category is something what I call myself is these hacker kind of cooks, you know, they're seldom using recipes, like to experiment with ingredients and styles and cooking methods, and more relying on flavor profiles. What do you think? Where do you think you fall in?
Actually, first of all, let me sort of share my two cents on this concept of health. See, health and diet in particular. I tend to look at it this way. See, to me, the point of diet is, from a physical point of view, keep your body in a certain shape. But the whole point of diet to me is a bit more philosophical than that. It's about exerting control over your senses, right? Because, see, what happens is, as a result of a lot of folks who diet, they don't want to change the quantity of food they take in, but change the stuff that goes inside them, because they want to cut down on fats and carbs and all that sort of stuff, or totally give up on certain things, right? So, like, for example, first thing that people tend to give up on a diet is sugar, because let's face it, it causes issues when consumed beyond a certain amount. But that lies in therein lies the key word, right? In a certain amount. And that's where this concept of you being in control of your body and exerting that control to say, look, I've had a slice of a proper baked New York cheesecake, and that is it. If I can tell myself that I am not going to have the second slice, what that gets you into is a space where you are in command of your senses, where you eat the real deal, but control the amount you eat. That to me is the true definition of portion control. And not only that, to me, that's also a sign of being in a space of mental health in addition to physical health, where you are actually in control of your senses, because that's kind of the whole point of the whole dieting, exercising, and eating right? Because you, unless and until you are in control of your senses, none of this makes complete sense to me personally. So I usually never try this whole low carb whatever, or you know, just doing subbing things. Like, you know, substitute butter with some applesauce or whatever, unless it's a flavor reason. But there is a reason why certain things are added into certain things, because they make them taste, look, feel, smell, you know, all those things in a particular way. And to me, it's really diluting that sort of stuff. So if somebody asks me what is my definition of diet is, give me a slice of good pizza, I'm going to eat that slice, and I'm going to say, I am done. And I'm not going to eat that second slice. That does two things. First, I satisfy my craving for a pizza. If I eat a, because I remember one of the restaurants in US, they actually served a pizza, which is essentially like a piece of bread. it had a sprinkling of tomato sauce on it, and that's it. It was like no cheese and some funky bread pizza. It tasted really bad, and I was like, I ate that and then I ate the real pizza. So it's kind of pointless. So to me, I would, if I want to have pizza, the way I look at it, being healthy while eating a pizza is have a good slice of New York pizza. I mean, in the US, you're blessed to have that stuff. You have a slice of that pizza, get all the cheese, get all the tomato sauce, get that good bread inside, and then you say, I am done. Now I'm going to burn this off or whatever. So that to me is the quintessential definition of health and diet. And I have a sweet tooth. I can't give up desserts. But having said that, I also have the benefit of being able to run a little bit. So that way I'm able to strike a balance. But then people have to figure out that balance for themselves. I suppose this is going off on a bit of a tangent.
I remember there was a time where you would bake something every weeknight.
Yeah.
And
like, absolutely.
What is wrong with it? Like, but then it is always be like, you know, just like this one plate of something. And
yeah.
And I have a similar rule, but it, where my thing is, for me, junk foods fall into this. Eat it if you can make it.
Fair enough. Yes, it's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, and that is how I look at junk food. Like, eat it. Yeah, sure. You want to have a cheesecake? Eat the entire cheesecake. I don't care. But make it.
Make it. Okay.
Make it yourself. Because by the time you make it and all that, then it's taking you 3 hours. You've probably lost the...
It's a very interesting way of looking at it. Yeah,
then you're not going to eat the entire cheesecake. So, you know, you want a cheesecake, you want to have cookies, you want to have a, you know, ice cream. Go ahead, make all the three and eat it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's only once you start getting into it, then like, oh my God, am I putting so much sugar into this? Like those things, you know, start hitting your mind right then.
Exactly. Because
when you just go to like the Cheesecake Factory and say, yep, red velvet, please.
Then
But when you start making, like, oh my God.
I miss Cheesecake Factory. My favorite was their white chocolate raspberry cheesecake. That stuff is like the bomb. It's really top stuff.
There's another type of cooking also, which I'm not going to classify, which is the vegans.
Okay.
Because I'm not sure how to classify them. Are they, is that a cult? Is that a movement? Is that a religion? I actually don't know.
Okay. See, I realize that as a species, Homo sapiens need to strike some kind of balance, right? Because I suppose, I don't know, the way I look at it is you need to strive. I personally, I'm a vegetarian. I mean, I do consider unfertilized eggs as vegetarian because unfertilized egg is as vegetarian as curd or cow's milk, at least from a science point of view. Now, see, if we look at it that way, maybe I'm wrong and I'm willing to discuss and learn more about this. But I don't think if everybody becomes vegan, I don't think agriculture is sustainable because you need animals to survive. And the thing is, as a philosophy, if the animal population, see, because animals will infringe upon your crop, you need stuff from them to sustain your agriculture. I'm not talking about, you know, cows and pigs. You need microorganisms all the time for your agriculture. So to me, you can't decouple animals from food bluntly and then expect your agriculture to sustain. I mean, that system will come down crashing like never before. But that's my view, and I'm more than happy to engage with people, learn from them. Maybe I'm missing something, but this is the way I see it from whatever limited knowledge I have. So, but having said that, see, the thing that is in their favor is that we are, as a society, moving towards like a glut. And I think, for example, US is an example of that. There is a glut of meat. The fact that the meat there is so insanely cheap, the fact that a meat is far cheaper than a salad, whereas if you look at the carbon footprint, meat is way higher than a salad. So that tells something about the way we are making our food from scratch. So they do have a point in that sense. But having said that, I think fundamentally you need a balance of plant-based food and animal-based food to not only get the nutrients that you seek, but also to sustain agriculture and the planet from a broader perspective.
Yeah, lab-grown meat is still meat.
Now, to me, it's still out of, but not because of the fact that no animals were harmed in the making of. I mean, for example, you give me papaya, any freaking papaya, I'm not going to eat it. I'm just going to kick it out of my sight. It doesn't matter if it's lab grown or if it's taken from a sewer. I couldn't care less. Well, actually, if you put papaya in a sewer, you're actually making the sewer worse. But that's a different argument altogether. So no, no papaya. So I would apply the same logic to that lab grown steak also. If I don't like papaya, I'm not going to eat it. Same thing goes for the steak. If I just don't enjoy that smell, sensorial space, I'm not going to eat it no matter what.
I have a very similar reaction to Karela.
What? Oh, you're shitting me, right?
Squids.
Have you seen that movie? Oh, come on. Have you seen that movie Lunchbox where she makes that Bharwa Karela? I mean, that is like quintessential.
I have made it for people and they've liked it. Similarly, you know, I won't touch brinjal, but then I've made.
Are you kidding me?
I made Mad Tea Party's tomato wangun, and
okay,
I just don't like the whole machine.
You are partially gult. No, how can you not like that guttu vankaya stuff, man? It is like
the whole mushiness of the vegetable is what totally turns me off.
You know,
it's squishy, it's mushy, and then the seeds are all, I don't know.
How do you deal with sambar sadam or stuff like that then? How do you deal with paripu sadam, sambar sadam, dal chawal? So that's also kind of...
The vegetables I like in sambar are the vegetables that hold their shape and texture. Like a drumstick or okra, shallots, things like that I like because they hold their texture and structure. No, and that actually takes me into what I was wanted to talk next is about this flavor, which is smell and taste.
Yep.
It's smell, taste, and I actually also put the visual component to it. I think there is the visual component also has some telling in it. Now, smell and taste are probably, you know, a much higher percentage of it, but flavor for me comes as a combination of all three. And that is where the brinjal falls for me is that just that squishy texture. And I've only found it palatable in two ways. One is eggplant parmesan, and the other one is the Kashmiri tomato wangan. And I figured out, no, it is because in both those places, that entire element is gone. Because in the Kashmiri version, right, it is dehydrated eggplant, right? So all the squishy part is gone. I dehydrated it in an oven because I cannot do it in the sun.
Yeah.
The eggplant parmesan, they have breaded and deep fried it to shit. So everything else is gone. Those are the only two things palatable for me.
Actually, speaking of eggplant, there is a place called Serafina in Bangalore. Now I think they've closed down due to some renovation or whatever. They had a dessert with eggplant in it. I think it takes some guts to do that. It tasted pretty decent actually. It's just that I had a priori knowledge that the dessert had eggplant. Otherwise, I would have enjoyed it a lot more. So I think I didn't realize that eggplant had that sort of a versatility. And it's apparently an authentic Italian dessert or something. It's not just doing something for the sake of it.
They have my respect.
It's kind of fun.
They have my respect, but you couldn't pay me to even taste that. So, if I just order a dessert of the menu and I eat it, and then as I'm eating it, I realize it's eggplant, it's fine. But knowingly, I can never order that.
Okay, fair enough.
So coming back to the smell, taste, smell plus taste equals flavor. I wanted to talk about the olfactory sense and the gustatory sense and how they come together to give what we know as flavor. So
So I guess in my line of work, we almost do this every single day. So as you said, there is gustatory, there is olfactory, but there is something also called retronasal, which is when they come together and give you a sensation of taste plus smell at the back of your throat, right? See, probably a gross example, but when you burp, you can internally make out the kind of food you had that causes that particular burp. There is a certain sensorial associated with a burp. You have like a spinach based burp or you have a paneer butter masala based burp. you can make out. And that is an example where that whole retro nasal thing pans out. So for example, try having like a cup of black tea with your nose completely sealed. It will taste quite different, particularly if you are having like a Darjeeling tea, which is all about more aroma and less taste. You will find that Darjeeling tea tastes like crap when you have it with your nose closed. Same thing goes for good black coffee also. So you try having it with your nose closed, it will taste completely different.
Right. So I think if you, the same nose closed example works even for cinnamon. So if you take a
absolutely
pinch of cinnamon and you, you know, plug your nose, you have that sandy, flavorless
exactly sense, exactly
which you get.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I guess in my line of work, we do this almost every single day while tasting tea. So, we have like some 30 to 40 attributes on which teas are rated. And, you know, when you taste them, you rate those teas on those particular attributes. So, I think tasting is a very intriguing sort of an aspect of food. Going back, see, the most interesting thing about food is the point. Why do you make food? It's to eat it. But ironically, your mouth is the last of the five senses that experiences it, right? So let me take an example of a sizzler. What's the first thing? So imagine you order sizzler at a hotel, and when the sizzler arrives, how do you know it's arriving? It's the sound, right? So I mean, without the sizzle, it's, I mean, there is no sizzle.
It's that sound, the entire restaurant, everyone's
Everybody is going to stare at that plate, right? So the first thing that experiences the dish is your ears. The next thing that experience, the next sense is probably your eyes. You're going to see that smoke. You're going to see what's on the plate. And you know, just see it visual. You savor it visually first. And there itself, you've made up quite a bit of your decision, right? I mean, if the sizzler doesn't sizzle, you're probably not going to have a good opinion of it already. You would think that, oh, this is too cold, or the whatever, you have already formed an opinion. Next comes your eyes. Unfortunately, eyes tend to have a huge impact on the judgment as far as food is concerned, right? If it doesn't look right, simple example is, in addition to sizzlers, chai. If it looks like a pale, almost milky thing, you already made up your mind, chai is not good. The next thing that is going to experience is probably your nose. In some cases, there is an element of touch involved as well. Because touch enables you to feel the texture initially. Only after that, your mouth gets to experience the actual dish. So to me, it's an interesting element of irony there, that, or it's an interesting dichotomy that, you know, I make food to eat, but strangely, or in an interesting sort of a way, my mouth actually is the last of the five senses to experience the food or the drink.
Right. And for listeners who aren't as much as nerds as we are, I just thought we should break it down a little bit. So our tongues, right? They are like chemical detectors or receptors.
Yep.
And they have these cells on the taste buds. And these interact with the chemicals that come in the food. You know, the saliva helps it break them down. Mm-hmm. And once triggered, these receptors send corresponding messages to our brain, which assembles all these set of signals, and it compiles it and say, okay, this is what this taste is. And that is why when, you know, we just spoke about the holding your nose test, that's a very good example of that. Another good example of this is when you eat something that is hot. When I say hot, I mean spicy, you know, like a chili or something like that. And the reason why it feels hot, or, you know, why you get this burning sensation in your tongue is because of capsaicin. Capsaicin is what you have in chilies, and you even actually have it in a bell pepper as well. And contrary to many people, the hottest part of the chili is not the skin of it and all that. It's that thin white layer that you have inside a chili. That is what has the highest concentration of capsaicin.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And what capsaicin does is it literally latches on to these receptors on your tongue, and therefore your tongue starts sending these signals to the brain saying, I have stuff that is between my receptors, and that's why it sends you this pain sensation. Contrary to a lot of people think, the best way to, you know, get this burning sensation of your tongue is not by drinking loads and loads of water.
Yeah.
It is actually by drinking milk.
Yes.
because milk has casein. And casein, what it does is, it's very much like that Tide or any ad that you see, Nirma Tide ad, where you see this the brown particle of dirt, and then the Tide particle goes and latches onto it and pulls it out of the fabric. That's exactly what casein does to capsaicin.
Yeah, brilliant.
And that's also the reason why, if you think, when you go to restaurants, like, I mean, here in the West, you have chicken wings, and chicken wings is always served with ranch, because ranch has butter. You have jalapeno peppers, where they stuff a jalapeno with cheese, and then they deep fry it, because the cheese also has that.
And they deep fry it because it's the US. Sorry, I couldn't resist
anything
that.
Anything that is deep fried tastes good.
We'll probably talk more about why also in maybe one of the later episodes.
Yeah, and there's also one other thing that can help with spicy foods, and that's carbonation. Carbonation, not as much as casein, but carbonation does still help. And that is why when you have something spicy, it goes well with beer or even just Coke or something like that, is because of the carbonation effect. So let's move on to then the olfactory sense. The olfactory sense is the is smell. There are different theories on how the chemical receptors that that detect smell work. But one of the simple things is that the human nose can detect at least around 1,000 different compounds. And you can actually take, I think, close to maybe 10,000 different odors, though we cannot tell what they are. But it's this sense of smell which turns these chemical compounds, and we call those as odorants.
Yeah. Essentially, different types of chemicals, they can be classified into large buckets, though. So, for example, if you look at esters, they are your fruity, they're responsible for fruity aroma. So, for example, wine actually has ethyl acetate, which is what you get when you take ethyl alcohol and chemically react it with something sour like vinegar. So wine has that characteristic aroma in some cases. One of the things that comes out of wine is ethyl acetate, which is a class of compounds, taking as an example. And the other class of aromatic compounds is what you call terpenes, and they cover like a vast array of smell. So the typical woody hay type of smell that you get, that is a certain type of terpene. I think the kind of aroma that you get in say the orange zest, lemon zest, that falls into terpene sort of chemical groups as well. In addition to that, you have your aldehydes, you have your ketones, and then you have your thiols. And now, of course, we are getting down into a territory of smells that is not particularly good. Again, I think terpenes usually are the terpenes and esters are the most aromatic compounds in terms of the good stuff. So whatever you find in strawberries, bananas, and like you said, right, these are very different smells. But thankfully, we can club them into certain class of compounds. And this also enables a lot of people to make flavors. So once you make these chemicals, for example, if you buy strawberry flavors from somewhere, which is, some of these chemicals that are made artificially and then loaded onto some sort of a matrix like a maltodextrin or something for you to add it in your cooking to make your life a little easier. So these are the principles that a lot of these flavor houses will use to generate these sorts of, fruity flavors or whatever. It's just that the way they process it, sometimes it's easy to make out that, this is something artificial and this is something that isn't. The classic example being vanilla. It's fairly easy to make out your vanilla essences versus like a good vanilla extract that you actually get by using alcohol or just from that vanilla bean paste from the bean itself.
Right. And the thing is, when you actually are smelling something, especially when you're cooking or in a dish, what you smell is only what are the volatile compounds that are there in the dish.
Absolutely.
There are non-volatile compounds also in the dish, but you don't get the smell. And one of the ways people do that is by, like you just said, ethanol, right? By adding alcohol, like wine and sauces and things like that. And what that does is it raises the vapor pressure, lowers the surface tension of the compounds, and therefore they will evaporate and pass into your chemoreceptors of the nose. And a good example of that is like how we were talking about the pinch test is if you grated potatoes, if you skinned a potato, grated enough, like 1 tablespoon worth of grated potatoes, and then you skinned an apple and grated 1 tablespoon of apple. When you look at it from far, they're both, you know, that whitish kind of thing. You can't tell which one is which. And this is where the olfaction is so important, because if you pinch your nose and you don't know what you're eating, there is no way you can tell which one's the apple and which one's the potato.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the air that, you know, carries the odorants cannot get into the nasal cavity, and therefore both of them taste exactly the same. Another thing I've also think is temperature also plays a huge role.
I mean, at least if you look at tea, there is a certain temperature at which you're supposed to taste tea. If you taste it too hot, you may miss some of the, I mean, as a sensorial in general. But yeah, it probably stems from the fact that different volatiles will have different boiling points and different partial pressures and different vapor pressures and whatnot. So yeah, absolutely. I think temperature plays a massive role in.
Yeah, like I think the ideal temperature for food is around like 95 Fahrenheit or like 35 degrees centigrade for it to hit the tongue. And colder foods therefore have you know, lower strength of sugar, which is why you actually have to add more sugars in for something that is colder. I think that's the same way why, you know, like red wine is, you know, served at room temperature, because the odors are conveyed best, whereas white wine is served generally chill, because you want to moderate the levels of the volatile compounds and the sweetness that is there. Because,
but yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you that temperature does play a major, major role when it comes to tasting food or beverages. But I mean, I'm honestly more curious about the cheese platter that comes with the wine. I hope the cheese had better be damn good, because I'm after a point, as you said, I'm totally mentally checked out and I'm more into the cheese that comes with the wine.
So now that you talk about, since you spoke about the cheese, this what does cheese truly do when you're pairing it with wine? I never understood that. I mean, it tastes good. I eat it. And I've, you know, I've done that, but I've never truly understood, like, is the cheese making a coating around me, or is like the is it cleaning my tongue? Like, what is it doing?
I probably better off talking to like a proper wine connoisseur, but they give you cheese and crackers. A cracker is a palate cleanser, so I think I know that. I think what I am pairing wine with cheese, maybe it's to, I think, form some sort of a synergy between what the cheese has to offer and what the wine has to offer, but basically to enhance certain aspects of the wine would be my guess, be it the taste or the overall sensorial profile or whatever. But I think we're probably better off talking to a proper wine.
Try to find someone on a future episode who knows wine. Yeah. Because the way I see it, it's like someone thought, let us bring two rich things together, let two rich tastes together. Thank you for listening to The Nerd Kitchen. If you thought this episode was fun, wait till you hear our next episode, where we talk about the basic tastes and how combining them at times can elevate your dish to a completely different level. Stay tuned, we'll be back.